Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibe. This week, Harvey Weinstein is back. The celebrated controversial film producer talks about winning Best Picture for The King's Speech and his unsuccessful attempt to buy back Miramax, the film company he co-founded and later sold to Disney. Critic Bob Mondello remembers screen siren Jane Russell, and songs from the dance and techno stars converging on Miami for the Winter Music Conference and Ultra Music Festival. But first,
the voluptuous screen siren and World War II pinup girl Jane Russell died yesterday at her home in Santa Maria, California. She was 89 years old. In her three decades as a star, Russell established herself as a capable actress, but as Bob Mondello reports, that wasn't really what attracted her many fans.
Jane Russell was a movie poster before she was a movie star. Howard Hughes commissioned what became a notorious billboard for her first Western, 1941's The Outlaw. Russell reclining on a haystack, gun in hand, with her blouse falling off one shoulder. The poster revealed more cleavage than the film would, but censors were enraged and kept the movie off all but a very few screens until 1947, when audiences could finally watch a sultry Russell comfort an ailing Billy the Kid.
You're not gonna die. I'll get you warm.
The orchestra seems impressed, though critics weren't. Still, audiences flocked to The Outlaw, drawn by reports of a specially engineered 38D bra that Hughes had supposedly designed for his leading lady. Russell said she never actually wore it and that the director simply didn't notice. Audiences had noticed her, though, and a few years later, the ad campaign for the musical The French Line simply read, Jane Russell in 3D. Need we say more? Perhaps inevitably, she was hired to promote Playtex bras on TV as ideal for full-figured gals. Still, she was a far more capable performer than all this emphasis on amplitude would suggest. In her biggest hit, she didn't exactly upstage co-star Marilyn Monroe, but she was sharp and funny when she mocked dozens of bodybuilders in a splashy production number.
Honey, you hurt yourself.
They ignore her, which is preposterous, but she's the brunette in a film called Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
I can't play tennis, my golf's a menace, I just can't do the Australian crawl. And I'm no better at volleyball, ain't there anyone here for love?
Jane Russell abandoned Hollywood in 1970 after about two dozen pictures, but she never entirely gave up public life, recording gospel songs, staying active with Christian and charitable organizations, and with a local singing group until just a couple of weeks ago. I'm Bob Mondello.
I'm apathetic and non-athletic. Can't keep up in a marathon. I need some shoulder to lean upon and a couple of arms to hold me. Ain't there anyone here for love?
Americans are in racially mixed marriages, more of them than ever before. One in seven new marriages now takes place between people of different races or ethnicities. There are more interracial couples on network television as well. They are on shows such as NBC's Parenthood, Fox's Traffic Light, and ABC's Mr. Sunshine. Still, TV critic Eric Deggans finds those shows rarely reflect the real drama of mixed marriage.
On Parenthood, Crosby Braverman and his fiancée Jasmine are so mismatched, they can't even load a dishwasher without getting in a fight.
I can't marry someone who will not let me make any decisions, okay? I'm starting to realize that you are very controlling. I mean, how we load the dishwasher?
He's flighty, she's focused. He's noncommittal, she makes long-range plans. Oh, and she's African-American, while he's a white guy. But like so many interracial couples on network TV these days, their racial and cultural differences almost never come up. Even in this awkward moment, which came during a pre-marriage counseling session in Jasmine's mom's church.
Who takes the lead when it comes to decisions about your child's education?
I do.
Have you both considered what religious instruction you'll give your child?
Well, I think we're going to probably encourage him to decide.
Yeah, but he's a child, so in the meantime, he'll go to church here, go to Sunday school, and yeah.
We never learn if the church is a black church or if Crosby feels uncomfortable there. He's more focused on their communications issues. And on its face, this seems like tremendous progress. It's a world where interracial couples face no disappointed parents, no odd questions from neighbors, and no total strangers asking why their kids are different colors. But as a black man who's been married to a white woman for nearly 20 years, I have to say, a world where interracial couples almost never discuss race doesn't feel real. What it feels like is avoidance. That's why I love this scene from an episode of Mr. Sunshine, the new sitcom featuring Friends star Matthew Perry. Here, Allison Janney from The West Wing plays a clueless boss.
There you two are!
And she's got an odd proposition for an interracial couple working in her office. A double date.
That's my fella's name, Darius Washington. Ring a bell, Alonzo?
No. Should it?
Well, I just assumed all you brothers knew each other.
But what really sold this scene for me was what the couple said after the boss walked away.
Did you just pick up on what was going on there?
Yeah, as subtle as it was, I got it.
She obviously just asked us out because she's dating a black man and then assumed that you would know him because he's a brother.
Look, it's no surprise Crystal is insensitive. This is the woman who handed Yo-Yo Ma her dry cleaning. But the point is, she wants to have dinner with us. She's trying. I think we should have said yes.
Really?
Yeah. And who knows, she spends time with us, and the next time she won't ask the guys from Los Lobos to park her car.
I've had that talk too many times. The can you believe it debriefing that happens after someone has said something either clueless or condescending. And that's what I see too many of these couples lacking on television. Race difference is an elephant in the room instead of a window into a new experience. It's time for network TV to fully tap the potential of these couples. Let them talk about the issues we're already tackling in the real world.
Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times.
Harvey Weinstein is a singular force in the movie industry. He and his brother Bob founded Miramax Films in 1979 and produced artsy, edgy, richly textured films that won awards in admiration. The Crying Game, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and Shakespeare in Love. Offbeat commercial hits like Pulp Fiction. They took a chance on dream projects like Good Will Hunting. The Weinstein brothers sold Miramax to Disney in 1993 and started an independent company in 2005. Last year, they tried to buy back Miramax and failed. It was one of the biggest entertainment stories of the year, in part because no other producer has a filmography as varied and as deep as Harvey Weinstein, including this year's Academy Award winner for Best Picture, The King's Speech.
What are you doing?
Get up! You can't sit there! Get up!
Why not? It's a chair.
No, that is not a chair. That is St. Edward's chair.
People have carved their names on it.
Listen to me!
Listen to you? By what right?
Because I have a right to be, and I have a voice!
Yes, you do.
Harvey Weinstein joins us from his office in New York City. Mr. Weinstein, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And when you saw, I guess, the first script of The King's Speech, what did you recognize potentially in this film that other producers might have overlooked because it, didn't have the obvious traits to appeal to a younger demographic?
You know, I'm lucky enough that at this stage of my career, it's what I think is appealing, you know, and it was so emotional and so rich that I took all that common wisdom of period pieces, stories like this, never work, you know, took all of that and just said, you know what, this movie makes me feel good. It's inspirational. I love this story, a piece of history that people don't know about. How inspirational. And the special effects, mm-hmm. I mean, all the 3D big special effects are fantastic actors in a room acting.
What kind of difference does an Oscar campaign make? Because you're often cited as the inventor of that particular media.
Scott, it happened to me a while ago, and I think the guy who best summed it up was John Travolta. He called me one day. He said, I just saw The Piano. He said, if that didn't have like 9 Academy nominations, there's no way in hell I would have seen that movie. And he said, I'm glad I did. He said, Harvey, you use those Academy Awards like when we were kids, we used to have the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. And I think, you know, for a large portion of the American public and actually the world public, the Academy Awards is the most meaningful film award there is. And it is a seal of approval. And it says, go see this movie. And, you know, maybe English royalty movies about stuttering isn't your thing, but you're going to love this movie.
What makes a good film?
A good film is good writing, first and foremost, because the writer starts with a blank page. And those words have to capture an imagination of a director, somebody like myself, producers, actors. And I think a good film is something that moves you and something that entertains you and something that, you know, enhances your understanding of life.
But what makes the difference between you saying yes to a project and I'd love to, but I can't?
It's the quality of the scripts that I get. It's all about reading. People say to me all the time, how can I get in the movie business? Or how do I get there? How can I have your job? And I just say, you know, I had an unfortunate accident when I was a 10-year-old kid. I played Cowboys and Indians. I was on the losing side of a guy who had like kind of a musket, like a Davy Crockett musket, and he poked my eye out. For 6 months, I stayed home because both my parents worked. But there was a librarian next door. Her name was Frances Goldstein. I knocked on her door one day and said, I'm bored out of my brain, you know. Can I read something? And thus began my education into the world of reading. So for those people who like to do what I do, the answer is read. Read everything. I read the Americans, I read the Russians, and I still to this day read a book or two every week and read every magazine article I can get my hands on.
Do you read the magazine articles about you?
Thankfully, there are few and far between lately, but there was one really good one in Vanity Fair.
Is your temper as bad as they say it is?
It's much better. It was as bad as they say it was.
Really?
Yep.
What changed?
I think the fact that I'm the father of four daughters, and I realized that, you know, they have all had, in their own way, terrorist training, you mean, at one time or another, and having been held hostage on numerous accounts, you mean, you know, by them, you know, I have mellowed over time. And I've also realized that they are the boss, and I'm living in their movie.
We're speaking with this year's Oscar-winning film producer, Harvey Weinstein. Let me ask you a bit about the failed effort to buy back Miramax. What did you learn from reverses over the past few years that maybe you didn't learn from success?
You know, I had 25 years in a row of unparalleled success, and then I had 3 years where, you know, it all seemed upside down. And I will tell anybody who goes through that, at the time, it's painful and torturous, but it's so good to come out the other side because I appreciate what I do. I've never enjoyed winning the Oscar like King's Speech, because normally I'm one of those guys who wins something and then 2 minutes later is going, what's next? Now I'm trying to continue the Oscar celebration for at least a month.
Do you see yourself as a businessman or an artist, or is your art the deal?
I see myself as a shortstop for the New York Yankees. Just unfortunately no one else did. You know, and I've just been jealous of Derek Jeter from the beginning of time.
So in other words, you don't see yourself as either.
I think in order to do what I do, you have to have an understanding of business. Mm-hmm. And then I think you also have to understand art. And disappointing, you know, people who think that I have this incredibly romantic life, I do. I have a great wife, great kids, and great family. But I spend a lot of time watching movies, studying movies, and I love the history of movies. So I am a geek on weekends who, like, watches old Chinese movies and all sorts of Italian language movies. And I'm constantly trying to improve myself in the area that I've chosen to work at.
Let me just ask you one more question. Recognizing that you're, by any reasonable definition, sitting on top of the world now, is it hard not to be able to get back the company that not only you and your brother started, but was named after your parents?
I think it was hard, and it is hard. You know, the people who bought the company, you know, ironically enough, are great people, and they're fun, and they've given us projects to do. You mean, like, to do a sequel to some of the great films that we made over the years, and that's been really rewarding, and they're approachable, and they recognize Mike Lang, who's the CEO of the company, every day recognizes, what Miramax is all about, and hopefully the Camelot that it was for movies. So it is tough. But, it's by the same token, it has made me appreciate things. So out of loss has come appreciation. I think in these guys' hands, Miramax will have a good future. And they've allowed me to be part of that in some small way because it is their thing. But hopefully we can create a new Miramax.
You haven't gotten mad during this interview at all.
I haven't.
Thanks so much for making time for us.
Scott, thank you.
Harvey Weinstein, produced The King's Speech, which, of course, won Best Picture at this year's Academy Awards, speaking with us from his offices in New York.
Early in his career, Bob Dylan was young and in love in New York. The object of his affection was a teenager named Susie Rodelot. Rodelot died Friday of lung cancer at the age of 67, and NPR's Margot Adler has this remembrance.
Susie Rodelot began dating Dylan in 1961 when she was just 17. She was described in Rolling Stone magazine as being the muse behind some of Bob Dylan's early love songs, including Don't Think Twice, It's All Right.
I once loved a woman, a child I'm told. I gave her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right.
A photograph of Rodelot and Dylan became the iconic cover of the 1963 album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. The two were photographed walking arm in arm down the street. In Dylan's biographical book, Chronicles, Volume 1, he compares Rodelot to a Rodin sculpture come to life. At the end of her life, Rodelot wrote her own memoir, titled A Freewheeling Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s. Rodelot told WHYY's Fresh Air in 2008 about their attraction to each other.
We were very curious, and we were both in search of poetry, and we fed each other's curiosity. I was exposed to all different kinds of music from a very early age. My mother loved Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, and Edith Piaf. And when you grow up in that, you just assume everybody else knows all this. Whereas with Bob, he heard this music and knew this is what he wanted to investigate, but he had a harder time finding it.
Rodelot came from an immigrant Italian communist family and was working for a civil rights group when she met Dylan. They kept secrets from each other. She didn't tell him about her communist background. He didn't tell her his name was really Zimmerman. Her own left-wing views may well have influenced Dylan's political awakening, but eventually they broke apart.
I just felt that there was I no longer had a place in this world of this music and fame, and I more and more felt more and more insecure that I was just a string on his guitar, I was just this chick, and I saw it as a small, cloistered, specialized world that I just didn't belong in it.
After she broke up with Dylan, she married an Italian film editor and they had a child, Luca. She was with her husband when she died. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Take heed of the stormy weather. And yes, there's something you can send back to me. Spanish boots are Spanish.
Every March, the beautiful people like Madonna and Diddy and Karl Lagerfeld, I don't know if he goes, but the beautiful people, they head down to Miami to join the gods of electronic dance music. And there, they float in and out of dance clubs to hear some of the best DJs in the world practice their trade. They come to Miami in March to check out two huge electronic music festivals, the Winter Music Conference and the Ultra Music Festival. The festival doesn't start till later this month, but the conference, which is a little like the Cannes Film Festival of electronica, kicks off Tuesday. And Sammy Yenigun, a music producer here at NPR who covers dance and electronic music, is with us for a preview of what we can expect. Sammy, can we just dance here in the studio?
Hey, Guy, if you think you can keep up with
me,
man, I'm down.
All right, let's go. All right, let's clear one thing up, Sammy. Dance, techno, electronic music, this is mainstream music in virtually every country in the world except here in the United States. It's not played on the radio. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, it's one of the great mysteries, right? Because this music started in Chicago and Detroit. And, you know, in some respect, New York City. Short answer, I don't know. Long answer, I think it might have something to do with kind of how it started. It started in the minority gay black communities of this country. And when it went overseas, it was placed in a new context. And it was allowed to kind of hit the mainstream and hit the top of the charts. And that was something that never really caught on here. I mean, you see music coming from minority groups like hip-hop, for example.
Right.
It's still just hitting the mainstream
Although
in a real
huge.
Way now.
I mean, it's one of the biggest parts of the music.
Now it is. It's been around since the 80s. I mean, you know, it took a long time for people to start accepting that it was something that could be a mainstream success.
And I love this music, but it took me a while to get into it, and it had a lot to do with the 3 years that I spent as a reporter in Berlin. I talk to people, and they say, you know, To me, it sounds like the same thing, the same beat or the same loop over and over again. You must hear that.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I mean, and at a very basic level, house music and techno music, the structure of it is this 4-4 structure that has a bass kick on every beat of the measure, right? Mm-hmm. So there is that basic template for all these songs. Now, right. Within that, there's tons of variation and tons of different rhythms and sounds. You know, no two waltzes are the same.
Right.
So I want you to listen to this this producer named Michel Kleiss.
And he's going
to
be featured at the Winter Music Conference?
He will be at the Winter Music Conference, yeah.
All right, let's hear him.
So he's from Switzerland, and this guy kind of has a funny story. He was a practicing psychologist.
Wow.
Until he broke his leg playing basketball. And so he was stuck at home for 3 months and got a little cabin fever and decided to start making music.
Hmm.
After a while, he developed this sound with all these Latin samples that he uses in a lot of his songs. And then he had this smash hit song called La Mezcla. And ever since, he's been producing these Latin house tracks that have been really big around the world. This track is called Litoral.
I love this. This is great.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, to me, this song screams summer. And I'm curious to see how it's received because these are the festivals that kind of determine what the big summer dance tracks are going to be.
And when you say the big dance tracks of the summer, this is not going to be music played on commercial radio in the U.S., but it is going to be played on the radio in Europe, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's got much better chance of being on commercial radio in Europe than here. But with that being said, I mean, this music is kind of on our mainstream radio. You look at the top of the charts, right? You got people like the Black Eyed Peas, who, by the way, Will.i.am is performing at Ultra.
And he was actually on our show a few months ago. This is one of the biggest bands in the world.
Right. He's got the French producer David Guetta, who's also a big draw at Ultra Music Festival, who produced their big hit, I Got a Feeling.
And Sammy, I gotta say, like it or not, this song spent like 10 weeks or something like that at number one on the Billboard charts last year.
Yeah, that's right.
Huge song.
It was huge. I mean, and there's other things. I mean, you listen to Kesha or Britney Spears or any of these chart toppers, they have this 4-4 structure with an electronic toolkit making these songs. I mean, this is electronic music in its kind of most diluted form.
I'm talking with NPR music producer Sammy Yenigan about some of the electronic artists who will be at the Winter Music Conference and the Ultra Music Festival in Miami this month. Sammy, who is producing that, you know, that really exciting new stuff right now? Who is the biggest DJ in the world right now?
Well, the biggest DJ in the world, I mean, that's a tough one. DJ Mag puts out a top
DJ Magazine.
DJ Magazine puts out a list of the top 100 DJs in the world every year, and DJ Armin van Buuren has been at the top of that list for 4 years running.
Right.
But this year at Ultra, this guy Tiesto is headlining, and he can sell out stadiums all over the world. I mean, He's huge. This is music that builds humongous amounts of tension in something called the build, and then releases all of this tension in what's called the drop.
Okay, so understandably, a lot of people might hear it and say, it's impenetrable. You know, it's not accessible. It's not easy for somebody to get right into it.
Well, there's this stigma attached to dance music that somehow it's anti-intellectual. It's not music that's just made by party animals. I mean, sure, people are dancing at these festivals, but it takes brains to make a track that gets people moving.
Right.
One thing I always try to tell people who haven't listened to much of this type of music is put on a pair of really good headphones and pay attention to the timbres of the sounds themselves. I mean, there's this record label in San Francisco right now called Dirty Bird, and they've been putting out some of my favorite music recently. The artists on it use really interesting sounds, twisting samples in really bizarre ways that have dark, grimy kind of moods to them. Take a listen to this sample, guy, and see if you can recognize where it's from.
All right. I do know that, I believe, and I say this only because we do so much music on the show, because otherwise I wouldn't know it, that's Snoop Dogg
and Snoop
Pharrell.
Snoop Dogg and Pharrell, drop it like it's hot, you're exactly right. Now Justin Martin has taken these mouth pops and clicks from the original, and he's rearranged them to make this up-tempo groover.
Mm.
Now, he's surrounded these sounds with these little details, like the hissing and that chubby, wet bass kick. And getting these sounds right is really difficult to do. This is music that doesn't need to be heard at a club or a festival. Mm. I mean, you can listen to it in a car or in your headphones in your room at home, but it does work well in a party setting.
So I suppose at this conference, the Winter Music Conference, which kicks off on Tuesday, is that right?
That's right.
I guess I'll be talking about the future, I mean, because I always do that at these conferences. What is the future? I mean, what are they going to be saying?
Well, genres like techno and house have been around since the 80s, but this type of music called dubstep is a relative newcomer to the world of right. dance music. It's really hot right now. These songs have a much slower tempo, but as you'll hear, that doesn't really take any of the energy away from them. This is a new track by an artist called Nero. A couple days ago, this was called the hottest record in the world by BBC Radio 1 show host Zane Lowe.
And Zane Lowe, I should admit, he's hugely influential in the British music scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he works for Radio 1, and they're kind of the source for a lot of this music, a lot of dance and electronic music. I mean, it's just way bigger over there.
Right.
But if we have enough of these conversations, maybe we can do something.
Let's
about
do it,
that.
Man. Let's
All
go.
Right.
You know what? I'm taking the headphones off. Let's go out.
Let's
go clubbing right now, Sammy.
All right.
That's Sammy Yenigun. He's a music producer at NPR. He specializes in dance and electronic music. Sammy, thanks so much for popping by and giving us a preview of the Winter Music Conference in Miami.
Thank you, Guy. Appreciate it.
And if you want to take a closer listen to any of these tracks, check out our website, nprmusic.org.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.